Welcome to the official podcast for St. Philip's Episcopal Church in Rochester, Michigan. You can learn more about our church at our website, stpfeeds.org. Our Sunday services are at 8 and 10 a.m., and all are welcome. This podcast is the sermon for Sunday, September 29th, 2019, by Eric Williams.
Well, I'm sure you were thrilled this morning in the lesson from Jeremiah to read a real estate transaction. I know that I look for inspiration from God's Word through real estate transactions all the time. Actually, Walter and I were talking, so many of our lessons recently have been about economics, haven't they? In one way or another, Jesus and our other lessons are focusing our attention on the issues of possessions, wealth, and today, wealth and poverty. In our gospel, we have the most extreme version of the separation of wealth and poverty in this parable that Jesus tells, a challenging parable, especially for those of us who live in the first world, something that pricks our conscience, something that causes us to think, what is going on here, and what is our sense of responsibility? It's a question that has vexed and plagued Christians from the very first. How shall we deal with differences in our economic status? From the very beginning, the Christian community was a hodgepodge of social classes. One of the things that made it distinctive was that people came together from different economic levels. St. Paul talks in 1 Corinthians about the problem when people would come to church and they would bring food and not share with each other. So the rich would have their beautiful, you know, I think about tailgating at football games. You know, some people go all out. They've got the tablecloths and the candelabras, and they've got beautiful catered food. And then someone else is lucky if they've got a filet-o-fish sandwich or something. This problem of sharing and the lack of sharing, the issues of community in the early Christian movement were a big deal, and it hasn't gone away. We are still struggling to know what to do with these differences in our world. I was reading an article this week that said, in America, let alone the rest of the world, in America today, the gap, we might call it a chasm even, if we were using the biblical imagery, between the very wealthiest and the very poorest is the greatest that it's maybe ever been, at least in the last 50 years. That is troubling. That's something that has troubled Christians from the very beginning. How can we trust in God's abundance when we see this separation, this problem, and we want to do something? Well, in Jeremiah's case, he makes the dumbest real estate investment in the history of humanity. I really love this. You have to step back. It looks just like a real estate transaction, but step back for a second. What is going on? Jeremiah is buying a field, an expensive proposition. He's spending a lot of hard-earned money on this field, and yet he's been telling people that the Babylonian army is going to destroy us imminently. They're coming. They're here. They're really at the gates. And so Jeremiah says, I know what to do. They're just about to take away all of our property. Let me spend all my money on a field. It is the dumbest possible move. But Jeremiah is not thinking in human economic terms. Jeremiah has a different agenda in mind. He puts this money down and buys this field as a prophetic act. He feels called by God to do this as a testament to his people about hope for the future. Yes, I've been telling you people, we're about to be conquered by the Babylonians. A bunch of us are going to die. The rest are going to be shipped out into exile, and there's going to be misery and suffering. It's going to be absolutely terrible. They also, by the way, reacted to Jeremiah's prophecy by throwing him in a pit. That was his reward. But the buying of the field is his way of showing his faith and trust in God. This season of conquest will not be the final word. Destruction is not the last answer. God has something prepared for us down the road. I'm not going to see it. Many of you are not going to see it, but God's redemption is coming. Jeremiah had that amazing prophetic ability to show, even in the very worst moments of his life and the life of his people, that his trust was 100% in God. He wasn't investing in a field. He was betting and investing on God. In our gospel today, we have this wonderful, incredible story about Lazarus. We should just stop and do a whole Bible study on this gospel. It's so fantastic. Usually, in most stories, the rich and powerful person has a name, and the poor person is anonymous. But Jesus flips it around. In this case, it's the poor man, Lazarus, who has the name. It's Lazarus who is the focus. The rich man has no name. He's the anonymous one. Lazarus, of course, lives in abject, utter poverty. He's lying in the gate hoping that someone will bring him crumbs from the rich man's table. But we never find out if the rich man even sent out the leftovers for Lazarus. We don't know if he even did that much. What we do know is that the rich man has everything he needs and more. And when the two men die, they are sent, one to heaven with Abraham and one to Hades or hell, which is a place of torment. We don't know anything more about these guys. We don't know if Lazarus was in many ways a moral person. We don't know if he was upright, if he was righteous according to the law. We know none of that. We don't know what the rich man was like either, except we do know a little bit. Because, and I love this part of the story, when he is sent to hell, he's being tormented down there, and he looks across the chasm, and he sees Lazarus there in the bosom of Abraham. And even at that moment, the rich man does not see Lazarus as a full and equal human being. He sees Lazarus as someone that Abraham can send to do the rich man's bidding. Send Lazarus to help me out down here. He's been so used to thinking of Lazarus as less than, as subhuman, that even when the tables are turned, he can't adjust his thinking. He is stuck in the wrong mindset. We imagine that his whole life he's been looking down on this guy, literally looking down on him, and even from Hades, he can't change his perspective. In Paul's letter to Timothy, we get the best kind of recipe for how to deal with some of these issues, a wonderful kind of description. And it talks about, Paul talks about how the Christian community ought to be different. There's always going to be people with more and less. We don't live, I suppose economists, we got a couple here today, could kind of imagine a scenario or what would it look like if everybody actually had the same exact amount of stuff. It's never happened in human history. I don't think it's going to ever happen. So what happens when we have these disparities? How ought we to live together? The big mistake that the rich man makes, the way that he is conditioned by his privilege, is that it prevents him from seeing Lazarus as a full and equal child of God. Because he can't see that, he's prevented from actually changing his behavior. Imagine a scenario where the rich man sees Lazarus, looks at him and says, "You are my brother. Our lives are connected. We live here together in this town. We live in the same space. How might we together shape our lives differently?" What if he was like the Good Samaritan in another parable and took this man into his home and took care of his wounds and fed him and helped him get back on his feet and gave him a job? What if they were friends? What if they worked together to change the lives of the people in their town? What a different scenario that might be. The chasm that Jesus talks about in this parable is a chasm that we know all too well, a chasm that could be bridged. And Abraham says, this can't be bridged anymore. It's too late. You had all the time you needed in your life. You had Moses and the prophets. If you needed any advice, It was all there in the Torah and the prophets. You could have learned how to live with this man your whole life. It's too late now. And then a little kicker at the end. Even if someone, imagine this, were to come back from the dead, they wouldn't listen. That was the sadness for Paul and the early Christian community, that even those who had experienced the resurrection of Jesus Christ were still trapped in this way of thinking of others as less than. A book that I want to recommend for you today is a book that I thought of as I was doing these readings. It's a book called Your Money or Your Life by Vicki Robin. And it's a personal finance book, but it's a personal finance book written from the vantage point of values more than about just making more money. She asks some pretty interesting questions in this book. One of them is she asks you to do a whole inventory of every dollar that comes into your life and every dollar that you spend. And then she says, do a little division exercise. Think about what you spend on various things, experiences or possessions. And then how much satisfaction, fulfillment, and joy do you get out of those things? What about the purchases that really were just not that great? Where does that money go? She asks you to look at some deeper questions of meaning. She tells the story. She basically says, if you want fulfillment in your economic life, in your financial life, there's four things you need to look at, four qualities that help you to arrive at this magic moment where you have enough, where enough is enough for you and where you're able to see beyond yourself. First is accountability, measuring where your money is and how it comes into your life and leaves. A second one is changing your internal yardstick. So many of us get trapped in comparing ourselves to other people. I have a friend who plays the lottery, but only, and this made me laugh, only when it's over $100 million. He said, you know, anything under $100 million, it's just not worth buying a ticket. You know, if you were to win $20 million or $50 million, that's not worth it. But once it gets to $100 million, he's all in. He's buying tickets. And there's this tendency to look at the next rung up, you know, wherever we are in our life. And I look back at my own life, and this has been true. When I had just almost nothing, I looked up at the next rung and thought, I'd be happy if I just made this much more. And then you get to that point, and you're like, well, I'd be happy if I got to this rung. And it is a never-ending ladder of misery. At some point, and this happens, I think, to most of us in our lives, you get to a stage of your life where you just stop comparing yourself to other people. You don't care anymore. And you find that the internal fulfillment is what really matters. So she said that's the next step. Another step is finding a purpose in life higher than your own wants and desires, because that also is a never-ending ladder. The opposite of getting is giving, and therein lies a secret to fulfillment. We have, she says, a natural desire to be generous and to share with others, and through that comes the sense of enough, of joy. And finally, she says, the quality is responsibility for living for more than just me, myself, and I. She tells the story of Buckminster Fuller. I don't even remember him, the inventor of the geodesic dome. He was a futurist and thinker, and he had gone through a crisis in his 20s where his life just fell apart. It didn't have any meaning for him. And he had this wonderful aha moment. I think some of us get these in our lives, these kind of turning point moments. And he suddenly realized, he said, my life is not mine. It's not for me. My life is for a deeper purpose. My life is really for the world. What an amazing insight. And then he asked himself a question and made it kind of his life's ambition and taught his students and got actually hundreds of thousands of people to ask this question. I want to make sure I get this right. He said, what if we did this thought experiment? What if... Now I got to find that. I got too many dog-eared pages here. Here we are. He said, so his game was, make the world work. So think about the world. Make the world work for 100% of humanity in the shortest possible time through spontaneous cooperation without ecological offense or the disadvantage of anyone. Make the world work for 100% of humanity in the shortest possible time through spontaneous cooperation without ecological offense or the disadvantage of anyone. He presumed that there's enough in this world for everybody. That there's enough for you, there's enough for me, and that if we each found our enough and had a vision of our lives as part of a whole, an interdependent whole, that we would find much greater satisfaction, happiness, and fulfillment. That we would be transformed by this work, and our world would be transformed as well. Jeremiah knew the ultimate truth, that for his life to mean anything, he had to invest himself 100% in God. And that is the same truth for us. Nothing has really changed. For us to find the deepest meaning and purpose and fulfillment in our lives, it's not going to come through getting a raise. It's not going to come through, despite what Jack says, getting the best possible tax cut. Where's Jack? He's probably out there. You're going to learn about that. Jack's also going to talk about how learning about the tax code can actually free you up to be generous and to do the things that you want to do. But ultimately for us, the deepest meaning, purpose, and fulfillment comes by investing ourselves, our lives, our energy, our work, our play, our money, our resources, our time, everything, investing that in God and God's reign and God's abundance and God's plan. When we do, our vision changes and we see how we are part of an interconnected and interdependent whole where the sum of the parts is so much more than any of the individuals put together. And we will truly be blessed with God's grace and peace and fulfillment. Amen.